Good morning, counsel. We are here for case number six of the morning. This is appeal number 20-2408, United States versus Jaishawn Jackson. We're going to begin with argument from counsel for the appellant, Mr. Drysdale.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Tom Drysdale, and I am here today on behalf of the defendant appellant, Jaishawn Jackson. Your Honors, the main issue before this court today is whether two separate exchanges of drugs and money separated by 58 minutes occurring in different locations after Mr. Jackson had the opportunity to abandon his criminal intent, it's two transactions or one.
That, Mr. Drysdale, that sounds to me like you're arguing duplicity.
Your Honor, this is not duplicity.
Why not?
And I can tell you why. Because when we look at the face of the indictment, because that is what challenges duplicity, this indictment reads that Mr. Jackson, on August 15th, 2019, knowingly and intentionally distributed 28 grams or more.
Stop there. Stop there. You're saying he distributed it twice, right? That's what you're saying. You're saying he distributed narcotics on that day twice, and therefore there should be two counts. And government lawyers do that all the time. He distributed at approximately 11 a.m., and then he distributed at approximately noon.
Precisely right, Judge. It is exactly what you just said. Government lawyers do this all the time. It's a prosecutorial discretion call as to whether or not what Jaishawn Jackson did was one transaction or two. They can charge it either way.
But wait a minute. But they can't if it's a question of law. Right? If duplicity is a question of law, it's not a question of fact.
But this isn't a duplicity argument, Your Honor. What we're arguing is the government can charge this case this way. The government can charge this case as a continuing course of conduct theory.
What in 841A1 is a continuing course of conduct offense? There's no scheme. There's no agreement. It's just distribute. It's a static offense, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. But this court has made it very clear that the government can, even if there are two transactions, charge them as one. But charging them as one is different than proving
that they are one. What case are you referring to?
Your Honor, United States, there's a couple. United States versus Moore, this court very clearly said, challenging an indictment is not a means of testing the strength or weakness of the case or the sufficiency of the government's evidence. And I would also point, Your Honor, to United States versus Davis, and that's this court as well. And this court noted that it is up to the government to decide whether to charge a continuous course of conduct or not.
Is that an 841 case?
It is, Your Honor. And it's a discretionary decision that is left to the government as to whether or not they're going to charge a continuous course of conduct theory. That doesn't mean that the government is somehow alleviated from their burden of proof. The government still has to prove that a continuous course of conduct happen.
By the way, is the continuing course of conduct instruction that was given here by the district court judge, is that a pattern instruction in the Seventh Circuit or in any other circuit?
Your Honor, I believe that it was an instruction that was agreed upon by the parties after Judge Mim essentially decided that the continuing course of conduct argument was going to be accepted. And so the parties crafted this instruction and it was agreed upon.
But no pattern. I guess what I'm asking is no pattern exists in any of these circuits that says a continuing course of conduct instruction should be given to a jury in an 841 context.
Your Honor, I do believe that the first part of the instruction was a pattern instruction. I can't recall off the top of my head, to be honest, Your Honor, but I know that this is an instruction that was fashioned after Judge Mim declared that this was illegal or this was a continuing course of conduct.
Did you object to the jury instructions or the verdict form? And the reason I'm asking that is I don't know what you would have expected the jury to do here based upon the verdict form and the jury instructions. The verdict form clearly states, we, the jury, find the defendant guilty or not guilty of the offense of distribution of cocaine as charged in count one. Count one charges he distributed cocaine on August 15th, 2019. I don't think there's any dispute that he's guilty of that offense.
I don't think there is either.
And then the next question is, did the government prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the quantity of cocaine base involved in the offense was 28 grams? What was the jury supposed to do with this? Other than answer yes.
Your Honor, our position would be that this never should have gotten to the jury because legally the government did not show that this happened in one continuous course of conduct. There's not a single published case out there where the distribution of drugs for money and then the distribution of drugs for money again constituted one continuous
course of conduct. Mr. Drysdale, let me ask you a hypothetical.
Yes.
So suppose count one in our hypothetical charges John Doe on January 1 of distributing 1 kilogram of heroin in two steps. Step one that occurred at 10 a.m. and step two that occurred at 11 a.m. in violation of 841B1 or 841A1 and, you know, B1A. Okay or not okay? And the fact pattern is at time one, they met at Walmart, and at time two, they met at the Waffle House. And when you add them together, there's 1 kilo of heroin.
Your Honor, according to this court, that is a permissible charge.
Okay. Now, if that's so, then your argument turns to, well, did the government prove it beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes, Judge.
Right.
That is correct.
Okay. One of the things that's curious to me in your brief, when you set out the standard of review, you talk about how a Rule 29 motion should be evaluated like a motion for summary judgment, and you reference Rule 56 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Can you think of any criminal case where we have ever talked about a review of sufficiency of evidence in a criminal case under the civil summary judgment standard?
I can't, Judge. I simply believe that there are cases that have made the comparison. But no, I cannot think of a case where this court has done so.
So Anderson versus Liberty Lobby, Celotex, Matsushita, et cetera, none of that, that's neither here nor there.
I believe that's correct, Judge.
So the standard that we're operating under is effectively the Jackson versus Virginia standard through the prism of Rule 29. Could any reasonable jury have looked at this evidence and concluded that the elements of the charged offense were proved beyond a reasonable doubt?
I think that's true, Judge, yes. And so essentially, though, that like I said, when we look at every case that has ever been published on this issue, it's always the government arguing for two transactions, where the defendant tries to argue, no.
I think for you to prevail, what you have to persuade us of is that no reasonable jury could have interpreted this sequence of events to amount to a violation of 841A1 at 28 grams or more.
Your Honor, we would agree that based on the Kelly case that the government cites, that acquittal is not the appropriate remedy for Mr. Jackson.
Okay, so why under the standard I articulated could the jury not find that there was a two-step transaction, and when you add them together, you're over the 28-gram limit?
Your Honor, simply because of the facts of this case. Drugs and money were exchanged. The first transaction was done. Under the government's theory, if Mr. Jackson had went back to Rantoul, Illinois, like he did, and never returned back to Champaign, he couldn't be charged with anything because he didn't complete the transaction. Of course, that's absurd. Like the Fourth
Okay,
Circuit-
so part of it, my sense is that Mr. Miller is going to say part of this depends upon how you define the transaction and what a jury could have concluded. One of the things that I'm very curious about is what was said when Mr. Jackson pulled his car alongside the CS and whoever that other person is, Miller?
His co-defendant, I believe.
Yeah, whatever her name is. Walker or something.
Your Honor, I believe what was happening.
What was said? It's on a DVD that we can't get to play. Words were said?
Your Honor, I believe that there was a discussion that Mr. Jackson would return back to... Your Honor, I do see I'm out of time, if I may answer your question.
Yes.
Okay. Your Honor, what I believe was said during that exchange was that Mr. Jackson would return to Urbana, Illinois with the additional amount of crack cocaine that he would then sell to the confidential source.
Okay, now stop there. Why can't a jury interpret, fairly interpret that to mean we'll return with the back half of the deal?
Because legally, Judge, he could have stayed home in Rantoul. He never had to come back.
Should
have gotten to the jury.
Sure, he could have, but the jury's dealing with what actually happened and reviewing
Your Honor,
under the standard we just agreed upon. If he had stayed at home, I wouldn't have been charged. There would have been no second step, and it wouldn't have been charged that way.
And that's precisely why the jury never should have been allowed to consider this. The judge should have ruled that this was legally two separate transactions.
Thank you, Mr. Drysdale. Mr. Miller, let's move to you now, argument for the appellee.
May it please the court, counsel. We are, of course, asking that the court affirm the conviction and sentence of the district court in this case, because we believe it was not only properly charged as one offense, but in addition, the jury found both the 841A1 offense and that the offense involved more than 28 grams of crack beyond a reasonable doubt, and the evidence supports that.
Mr. Miller, can I ask you a question?
Yes, please.
Could the government here have charged the defendant with possessing with the intent to distribute and distribution of crack cocaine in the same count?
In the same count?
Yeah, that's charged all the time, isn't it? That on or about
such
a date,
yes,
the defendant possessed with intent to distribute and distributed crack cocaine. And then if he possessed it, he's with the intent to distribute, he's guilty. And if he distributed it, he's guilty.
Correct, Your Honor, because we would say that really incorporates Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 7, which talks about an offense may be charged by if different means are used to complete an offense, they may be charged separate conduct as one offense.
But here you
which
only
is what
charged,
we believe happened here.
Here you only charged distribution, which means transfer. So how do we draw the line as to whether or not this was one transfer or that this was multiple transfers? Putting aside the waiver issues and the duplicity issues and things like that, how do we, as a court, how do we draw the line and instruct lower courts that in this case it was one transfer, where in another case it would be two transfers?
To incorporate what the Davis case said, and as my understanding of the Davis case is that was a duplicity case, but was not an 841 case, that it was a fraud case. But in that case, the court talked about the line is a difficult line
to
draw.
But hold on for a second. I don't think scheme cases, I think scheme cases are totally different, and they don't help us in that analysis because 841 is clearly a static offense. You distribute, you're guilty. There's no continuing course of conduct under 841, or is there?
Well, I agree with that as far as the scheme cases, Your Honor, and I was just commenting on the question to the defense counsel whether Davis was an 841 case. We agree that is an issue. I think the unit of prosecution, I believe, is a distribution. But where you draw the line is, as said by the cases, it is a difficult line to draw, and it's one that's going to be based on the specific facts of the case.
But hasn't Congress drawn it for us?
Well, I think if we look at cases, if you're suggesting it's just each time you hand drugs to another individual, the answer would be no, because we know that in a case, in fact, I think the Fourth Circuit case that was cited by defense says that if you're in a transaction where a defendant hands one baggie to a confidential source, then hands another baggie to a confidential source, then hands a third baggie to a confidential source at the same time, same place, same confidential source, that must be charged as one offense, is at least what I believe the Fourth Circuit has said. So it's not so clear that simply one distribution is each distribution must be charged separately. I think as we look at the facts in this case, we believe that the facts establish this is one distribution. As there was an agreement to distribute 35 grams of cocaine for $1,800. And to get to the court's question, when the defendant showed up, it was supposed to be, the agreement was it was going to be two bags to complete that distribution. And we all would agree if the defendant had showed up with the two bags, handed one bag at that time, handed the second bag at that time, that would be one distribution. At least I believe that's what the cases say. In this case, though, the defendant chose to only show up with the one bag.
Mr. Miller, what happens? Yeah. What happens? The second the defendant goes back to his house, he gets a second bag of crack cocaine. He shows up. What happens if your informant an hour later was not available? So the DEA, I don't know if this DEA FBI case, it doesn't matter. But let's say the DEA sends in a different informant to retrieve the second bag of cocaine. The defendant's conduct has not changed. Is that still one transaction or does that now become two?
I would argue under these facts, that's one transaction. There was one transaction for 35 grams. And the key to answer the court's question, as we put in our brief, what did the defendant say when he pulled up along the CS before leaving the scene of the initial meeting? He said, I'm going to get the rest. I think that's a key fact here. He didn't say, I'm going to go get you more crack cocaine to do a separate deal. He said, I'm going to get you the rest. In other words, I'm going to complete the transaction that we negotiated. Again, it's going to be fact specific in a case. The line, as we noted, is not always easy to draw. But we think in this case, this is clearly on the side of a single transaction. We could see a defendant complaining if it was charged as two. Wait a second. There was one negotiation. There was, I think another key point here is that
the negotiation, though, occurred between the CS and that, who's that, co-defendant Walker?
Walker, Marnetta Walker, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that actually makes this more one transaction. And the reason I say that is because Walker and the CS were together the entire time. They never left each other's company. And recall, both defendants were charged in this single count together. Walker pleaded guilty to the single count distribution of more than 28 grams of cocaine. And at Jackson's trial, there was a aiding and abetting instruction. So there is a little more nuance to
the
facts.
Yeah, there is. There's not an 846 charge, though, either. And so that's why
Your Honor.
Right. And Jackson didn't talk to the CS and negotiate the original terms and conditions of the deal. Right.
So that's correct.
So we get Jackson involved when they're doing the pull up in the first parking lot.
That's correct. But the CS talked to Walker. Walker was convicted of and pled guilty to the single count distribution of 28 grams. So if Jackson is an aider and abettor of that, regardless of whether he even talked to the CS, then he is guilty of the principal offense as an aider and abettor. So even under those facts, again, we have Walker who's pled guilty to those facts as one account distributing more than 28 grams. Walker stayed with the CS throughout the entire transaction. The agreement between Walker and the CS was to do a one deal for 28 grams. The CS was going to call off the deal when the CS didn't get the second baggie and only was convinced by both Walker and Jackson to complete the deal because Jackson was going to get the rest.
So was it?
And then
was
that
it,
occurred within an hour.
Was it your theory that this was an attempt by Jackson to, this was a shorting?
Well, it was certainly a short. We don't have evidence in the record as to why Jackson would do that. We certainly know that there are defendants who are savvy enough to attempt to deliver amount of narcotics that would be underneath the threshold. We don't have any evidence that that's what took place in this case. He certainly, Jackson and Walker, shorted the CS on both the 28-gram baggie, it was about 26, which is not unusual at all, and then the 7-gram baggie. But as to whether Jackson intended to try to avoid the threshold,
A
possibility.
You're talking about
the
criminal code threshold?
I'm sorry?
You're talking about the criminal code threshold?
Yes.
No. I'm thinking of it much more simply. Sell less drugs, get more money. Not expecting the CS would have a scale in the car.
Right. I think anyone who's been involved in drug transactions understands that dealers routinely short. Here he shorted the CS on the 28 grams and didn't even bring the second baggie. The problem for Jackson here was that the CS had specifically negotiated with Walker there would be two baggies, a 28 and a 7 gram, and he only showed up with the one bag. And so then the CS says, well, I didn't even get my second baggie. But I think you're exactly right that Jackson, of course, was trying to get more money for less, for selling less drugs, which is also an important point here on the amounts. And I know it's in our brief, but really is that to show this was a completed deal, when Jackson showed back up and was paid the remainder of the agreed $1,800, $300, if this was a separate deal, Jackson would and Walker would have been selling a smaller amount for a lesser amount per gram. And we know that, and there was expert testimony at the trial, that when drug dealers, just like any wholesaler, when they sell larger amounts, they charge less per gram.
Mr. Miller, let me switch topics with you real quick here before we run out of time.
Yes.
If we find that this is duplicity, should we treat the defendant's Rule 29 motion as an untimely Rule 12 motion?
Well, I think whether you would find duplicity or not, it was an untimely motion under Rule 12B. For the reasons we state in our brief, this was clearly something that they would know about before trial that they should have brought. This is a duplicity argument in our estimation, Your Honor. And it's untimely. And I urge the court on this to not just waive the waiver and go to the merits, because I think there are some good case law out there that discusses the importance of enforcing those Rule 12B3 limitations to avoid precisely the confusing situation that happened in this case with non-pattern jury instructions. Just to answer the court's question, that was not a pattern instruction on the continuing course of conduct. That was an instruction caused by the defendant's untimely Rule 12B motion. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Drysdale, we'll give you a minute in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The instruction was caused by the government's duplicity argument that they made at 7:30 p.m. in the middle of trial. The indictment is not duplicitous on its face. The indictment very clearly on its face is not duplicitous, and that is the standard for the Rule 12 motion. The government's entire argument on the continuing course of conduct theory hinges on an agreement. But it doesn't matter what they agreed to. It matters what they did. And this agreement argument was tried by the defendant in United States versus Weather. And that's the Eighth Circuit case that we cite, where there was a distribution of drugs for money, there was an 8-minute gap, and there was a second distribution of drugs for money. And the defendant said, well, we agreed originally to one transaction, and therefore that's what I'm guilty of. And the Eighth Circuit said no. Congress has defined delivery and distribution, and they, based on that definition, Jaison Jackson distributed drugs twice on August 15th, 2019. We asked for a remand for resentencing under B1C. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Drysdale. Thank you, Mr. Miller. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.